Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Justin Drower, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We're here today to discuss the decision handed down on March 28th in Wilkins v. United States. It's my honor to introduce our guest today, Professor Ilya Soman. Professor Soman is a professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. His research focuses on constitutional law, property law, democratic theory, federalism, and migration rights. We're very happy to have him come back to SCOTUScast to talk about Wilkins v. U.S. after the decision. So I guess, Professor Soman, we can start out, if you'd like, by talking about the breakdown of the vote and any key takeaways from the decision.
Sure. The case features a very unusual ideological breakdown of the justices. It's a 6-3 vote. In the majority, we have the three liberal justices, with Justice Sotomayor actually writing a decision, but also three conservatives, justices Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, and Amy Coney Barrett, which is not a breakdown that you see very often. And obviously, having dissent, the other three conservative justices, Justice Clarence Thomas, writing a dissenting opinion, and then joined by the Chief Justice John Roberts, and also by Justice Samuel Alito, which is a fairly unusual alignment. I don't remember seeing this particular one, at least not in any significant case up to this time. But it may have to do with the specific nature of this case, which on the one hand pits the rights of property owners, which prevailed, but on the other side is protection for the federal government's sovereign immunity. And while the liberal justices historically are less interested than the conservatives in protecting property rights, they're also less enthusiastic about sovereign immunity than at least some of the conservative justices are. So it may be that for the conservative dissenters, their love of sovereign immunity overcame concern for property rights. And for the liberals in the majority, their at least relative suspicion of sovereign immunity, I think, played a role, plus their general belief that we should not put too many procedural obstacles in the way of citizens who want to sue to vindicate their rights, though both right and left have some inconsistencies in that regard, certainly.
Thank you for that. So are there any other than the composition of the vote, are there anything surprising in terms of the reasoning behind the decision, or anything that's of note for the implications going forward now that we have this on the books?
So I think there wasn't too much surprising in the majority's reasoning, at least not to me. The majority essentially said that the 12-year statute of limitations for bringing claims under the Quiet Title Act, which enables property owners to sue the federal government if the federal government, they believe, has infringed their property rights, their land, that 12-year statute of limitations is not a jurisdictional constraint. That is, if it's been violated, federal courts don't automatically lose jurisdiction. Rather, it's just a procedural, quote-unquote, claim processing rule, which gives plaintiffs more scope to potentially argue the 12 years don't apply to them, or that it told at a different time, or that the government didn't properly raise the issue, whereas the 12-year statute of limitations could be raised at any time if it was jurisdictional. And the majority essentially said there's a presumption in favor of looking at this as a claim processing rule. And here, there's nothing in the text of the act or precedent which overcomes the presumption. I was a little bit surprised at the very strong emphasis on sovereign immunity in the by the dissenting justices. Sovereign immunity did not feature that prominently in the lower court litigation of this case, but perhaps I shouldn't have been surprised, because sovereign immunity has been a big deal at the Supreme Court in other cases. And Clarence Thomas, the author of the dissent, is a longtime champion of strong sovereign immunity. He's probably been more consistent about that, as far as I can recall, than any other current Supreme Court justice. So in retrospect, I should have foreseen that aspect, but I didn't. Going forward, I think the big implication of the case is that there will be at least somewhat more flexibility than there would have been if the case had gone the other way for property owners to use the Quiet Title Act to sue federal officials when they have possibly infringed their property rights. And this is potentially very important for property owners like the plaintiffs in this case who own property in the Western or Central and Mountain states where the federal government owns enormous amounts of land, which often abuts or even intersects or bisects private property owners, and therefore federal officials sometimes deliberately, sometimes just negligently violate people's property rights, resulting in disputes like the one in the present case, where the federal government had an easement over these two owners' land for many years that was intended to just allow access to people engaged in the logging industry. And after 40 years of it being used for this limited purpose, the National Park Service basically put up a sign saying there is general public access here. And then all sorts of people could go through, including hunters, tourists, and others. That caused considerable disturbance that was of great annoyance to the property owners in the area. And so they chose to sue, but for various reasons, things dragged out long enough that these 12-year statute of limitations, at least potentially, came into play. And there are similar scenarios that arise with other property owners, particularly in these Western states where the federally owned land is a very large part of the state, and therefore many issues arise.
All right. I think that that probably sums up the case pretty well, unless there's anything else that you think is worth
mentioning. There is one thing I should mention. This case was litigated on behalf of the property owners by the Pacific Legal Foundation, which is also my wife's employer. She herself was not part of the litigation team on the case, but the viewers or listeners should know this. A second point that I think is worth mentioning is that this case is not over. It's been remanded. It's still possible that the 12-year statute of limitations will bar the case, even as a claim processing rule. The lower courts will have to consider that. If it does not, then they will have to rule on the merits of the property claim. And I believe there's a takings claim as well.
Excellent. Good to know. Thank you very much, Professor Sobin, for breaking down the decision.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.